Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tonight on PBS, on the wonderful series American Experience, a fine film is airing that is going to shed light for you, as it did for me, on a now almost completely forgotten figure who really helped shape the Allies' victory in World War II, and that is not overstating the significance of a man named Alfred Lee Loomis. He was someone who, although professionally for many years, was an attorney and a banker. In fact, in his heart of hearts, he was a scientist and a lover of science. And he ended up being quite instrumental in some of the most important scientific advancements of the 1930s and 40s, particularly some advancements that really played a significant role in the Allies' victory in the Second World War. But this largely untold story has been awaiting a fine film to in which we could understand this man and his importance better. That film is what we can watch tonight on American Experience. The film is titled The Secret of Tuxedo Park, and we'll explain that intriguing title in just a moment. The director and writer of this fine film is Rob Rapley, and he is responsible for some very fine films that have already aired on American Experience, including Murder of the President, which told the very, very intriguing story of the assassination in 1881 of President James Garfield, another film called The Abolitionists. He also had a great hand in that fine series that aired, I believe, last year called The Great War, which sheds light on the First World War. And again, the film that is airing tonight on American Experience is called The Secret of Tuxedo Park. Rob Rapley, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm delighted to be speaking with you, and this was a story I knew absolutely nothing about. And most of the time when I say that, in fact, that really isn't literally true. Usually I've caught at least a smidge of a story, but feel like I knew absolutely nothing about it. But really and truly, I don't believe I have ever heard this name, nor ever heard anything at all about Alfred Lee Loomis. I wonder how you came to know him and to know that his story was worth telling in this fashion.
To be honest, I heard about him through Janet Conant, who wrote a wonderful book called Tuxedo Park. And she came across it by a rather circuitous route. She was looking into a relation of hers and kind of stumbled across this story, and it got deeper and deeper and deeper following this character, and she had meant to write a book about somebody else and ended up writing it about Alfred Loomis because it is such an amazing story. And I think it is unknown, completely unknown, really, because or was completely unknown because he valued his privacy so highly. He hated publicity. He hardly let anybody take his picture, even, which didn't make our lives easy. and so, after he played this kind of central role in the war, and then really disappeared afterward. Whereas all the other kind of lions of the Allied victory were being paraded around and given awards and so on, he kind of shuffled off to Long Island and really kind of disappeared from the public eye.
Right. And as your film explains, it was also a case of the whole business of science really changing radically. In a sense, he ushered in a new era in which what he did was, at least to some extent, somewhat obsolete. And I suppose that also contributed to his obscurity. Speaking of obscure, Let's explain to our listeners this title, The Secret of Tuxedo Park. First of all, what is Tuxedo Park?
Tuxedo Park is still there. It's a community, an affluent community that was built outside, I think it's about 30 miles outside New York City, and it was built in the late 19th century, I believe, really as an enclave for the very wealthy, and it was one of the first gated communities. And Loomis kind of joined the ranks of that class as a banker in the 1920s and moved his family up there. It's called The Secret of Tuxedo Park because really what he was doing was such an anomaly. It was a very staid, almost insular kind of community, and what he was doing just really did not fit, you know, building a laboratory in the basement of his mansion and carrying out really world-class science there.
Mm. Your film takes some time to explain who he was in kind of his formative years, in particular the family in which he grew up and the kind of father he had. And clearly you believe that it is important for us to understand the father of Alfred Lee Loomis if we are going to understand Alfred Lee Loomis himself.
I think that's right. Loomis, well, like so many people, he was shaped by his upbringing, in his case, a rather unhappy, chaotic upbringing. His father was a philanderer, womanizer, and just very unpredictable and erratic and a poor father in many ways. And he shipped the kids off to boarding school, as was the practice then at the age of five or six, I think. And then he brought disrepute upon the family and squandered their money. And so Loomis grew up with a good name, which was very important in those days in late 19th century New York, but not much money. When his father died young, the responsibility for supporting the family really fell on him, which is why he had to abandon his real calling, which was science. In those days, that just wasn't a career that, other than kind of bespectacled oddball university professors and so on, it wasn't a respected, lucrative career that would have brought in the kind of money he needed. And so he went into banking and really set himself on being the opposite of his father, on being a reliable, rather staid person in playing that role in his family, and really buried his scientific impulse and just tried to follow this narrow path, but he couldn't stick with it in the end.
Right. Actually, one of my favorite lines in the whole film in talking about the childhood of Alfred Lee Loomis and how difficult that that childhood was is a moment when someone, in describing how this young boy tried to sort of deal with all of the disappointment and turmoil in that household, found solace in science. And I think that's such an interesting thing to think about, that for someone in a home so unhappy and racked with so much chaos, science would be a place, in a sense, of refuge and stability. I think most of us, no matter what we think about science on kind of a personal level, never think of it in those kind of terms as offering that kind of comfort to a young person going through something like this.
Well, I think that what it offered, as I mentioned, his family life was so chaotic. They didn't really have a home. He was being shuffled between families and so on. What science offered was certitude. And it was really an escape from the chaos into something that was true and that had an answer and so on. And also, he was just so brilliant, really. As we mentioned in the show, he was a chess prodigy as a child. And I think before he was 10 years old, he could play chess without seeing the board. That he would memorize the board and he could just play a chess game without ever seeing the board, and soon afterward was able to play several games simultaneously that way. And so there was this prodigious ability to visualize, and I think that was kind of one of the keys to his scientific aptitude. So he was working with, as I say, it was a retreat from the chaos, and he was also just gifted with a mind that few of us, when we approach science, we don't approach it that way.
Right. You tell us that as a young adult, one of the ways he was able to foster that scientific interest and scientific talent was in tinkering around and creating small inventions, some of which he actually sought patents for. Explain the kind of things that he was exploring at this point. This is just before the First World War.
Sure. This was really kind of your garage scientist. He was just disappearing. He'd come home to the wife after work or whatever, and then just disappear into his garage. And he patented things like a fire extinguisher and a slide rule for calculating securities. And so even as he was living in Tuxedo Park and trying to put up a very the most ordinary front possible, that he was pursuing something very unlike his neighbors in the background, patenting these kind of oddball small inventions and so on, but very, very clever, but not earth-shattering.
Right. Maybe one of the first really significant things he managed to develop occurred during the First World War. Explain what he helped develop that contributed to the new weaponry of the First World War.
Loomis was sent to the Aberdeen Proving Ground, which was the Army's kind of scientific experimental facility during the First World War, and he loved it there. Again, it was the opposite of the chaos that he'd grown up with, and he was working with really first-rate scientists, and he developed an instrument to measure the muzzle velocity of a cannon. And artillery was the most important weapon of the First World War, so refining the accuracy of artillery was a very important thing, and measuring muzzle velocity was the way to do that. And it was characteristically a kind of very clever, simple invention that would allow an artillery crew to hit a target, say 10 miles distant, but quite accurately. And it was so good that it was actually, in a slightly modified version, became standard equipment through into the Second World War.
Mm. One of your guests, in describing some of this work that Alfred Lee Loomis did at this point, has a very interesting observation about kind of the overall world of science at this point in the late teens into the early 20s. In fact, I think she uses some image about how the world of science was just kind of exploding as though it was going from black and white into color. And of course, Loomis was really anxious to be part of this. Explain what is behind that image. In what way was the world of science such an exceptionally exciting arena at this point in time? In what ways was it shifting from black and white into color, so to speak?
Well, the First World War, of course, had seen science kind of turn on its creators, and it was actually called the Chemist's War because of refinements in poison gas and so on. But then after the war, that all those advances and of course flight and photography and then all these things that had come just a staggering distance in 4 years under the pressure of war were turned to civilian use. And so the horizons expanded dramatically. And if you think of just fundamental inventions that were either new or developed so far during the war that they really changed things like radio and, as I mentioned, flight and so on, that any one of them would have been really exciting. But to put them all together, people really felt like science held the answers to a better world. And so there were a ton of magazines, like Popular Science kind of things, that just dreamed up wonderful scenarios of, you know, flying cars and all these crazy things. And but behind it was a very real situation, which was that the world of science had been transformed by the war, and now there were endless opportunities in the civilian world to be exploited.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Rob Rapley about a fascinating documentary film that is airing tonight on the PBS series American Experience. It's called The Secret of Tuxedo Park, and it explores the life of Alfred Lee Loomis, who would, in the 1930s and into the 1940s during the Second World War, would be a very, very important figure in the scientific community here in the United States, and ultimately played a very significant role in the Allies gaining victory in the Second World War. And so we're exploring his story. Ahead of us talking about all of this exciting work that he, in a sense, bankrolled, we need to talk about how he managed to acquire such a staggering wealth, which enabled him to do some of the important things that he did. Explain how he was able to become such a very, very wealthy man during the 1920s, and how he was able to, in a sense, sustain his wealth when so many people lost their wealth in the Great Crash.
Well, one of the new scientific fields that was transforming the world was electricity. And really, after the First World War, he saw that electrification was going to be a huge, huge, huge industry. And through some of the contacts that he'd made during the war at the Aberdeen Proving Ground, he kind of had an inside track on exploiting that. And he realized that there was going to be funding necessary for this. There were going to be billions of dollars necessary to fund this electrification of the country. And he and his partner really became the central figures in that, and they were kind of the midwife is maybe not the right expression, but they kind of helped usher in this electrification. And to be honest, I think Wall Street was a much even wilder place then than it is now, and I'm sure there was a lot of tactics and strategies that they used that would probably be frowned upon now, insider information and so on, but that was par for the course then. And so he became very wealthy very quickly, and remarkably, at the beginning of 1929, he just realized they sold one little branch of their company, and it sold for, you know, 20 times what he thought it was worth, and he realized that, okay, this isn't making sense anymore, that the market is just not logical. And he turned to his partner and said, we got to get rid of everything. And they, after spending, you know, the better part of a decade building up this company, just on the strength of that hunch, they got rid of basically everything that they could. And sure enough, when the Wall Street crash came in October of 29, they basically came through without a scratch, and very, very few people had been able to do so. There was some resentment about it. You know, if you can imagine, a lot of people who had lost everything wondered how this had happened. But really, in that case, there was no inside information. He really he really saw it coming and called it, and just kept it to himself, and they came through. And as a result, you know, they had a lot of money in the early 30s when nobody had any money, and they were able to make, they estimate another $30 million in the first, between 1929 and 1932, and in the bottom of the Great Depression. And in those days, that was just a staggering amount of money.
Right.
Enough that he could afford to just walk away.
Right. So this was, in a sense, a second fortune that he amassed on top of the first.
That's right.
And then he is in a position to kind of go on to do what he does and what amounts to the real heart and soul of your story. I think it's really important right here for you to explain something that seems to have been a great inspiration to Alfred Loomis, and in a sense, he modeled himself after some of the wealthy men in Britain who had, in a sense, helped to underwrite the whole business of what has sometimes been called gentleman science and gentleman scientists. Explain this phenomenon in Britain and the kind of inspiration that it was to Loomis.
That's right. He, as he acquired his fortune, of course, he was able to travel extensively, which few people did in those days outside the wealthiest class. And he, in Britain, because of his interest in science, visited people like Rutherford. These were wealthy gentlemen, brilliant. They funded their own operations. They set up laboratories and had staffs and all the rest of it, and really pushed back the frontiers of science. But it was a model that really appealed to him, that you basically are independent, and it was very different from the way we think of scientists today as part of a big operation, usually funded by university or industry or whatever. It was a kind of noblesse oblige science, you know, that the something that the upper class did, and to be fair, that, you know, that these were genuinely brilliant people. It wasn't they weren't dabblers. These were the people who were making the important scientific discoveries at that time.
Hmm. So explain what Tower House was.
Tower House was an answer to a problem that Loomis had. He set up an operation with a friend in his garage. They decided that they were going to investigate high-frequency waves, and so they bought this massive high-frequency oscillator from General Electric, installed it in his garage, and started doing all these experiments. And as you can imagine, this just did not fit with the neighbors in Tuxedo Park. And so he looked around and bought another building, a mansion, in Tuxedo Park called Tower House. It had been abandoned for years, and naturally enough had become the source of subject of a lot of ghost tales and stuff that nannies told their children in Tuxedo Park. And he converted it into really a world-class laboratory, the whole thing. The laboratory was in the basement, the offices were on the ground floor, and then upstairs were apartments and dining rooms and so on. And I visited it, and it's no longer what it was. It's been converted, but you can see just how opulent and beautiful this was. And you can imagine, as we discussed earlier, that scientists in those days were not rich and powerful for the most part. They tended to be, other than these few gentlemen scientists, rather underpaid university people, and they would come to this and enter this kind of magic place that he'd built up, and, you know, with liveried servants standing behind every place at dinner and so on, and they thought they'd died and gone to heaven, but it was that luxurious, but it was also really a world-class laboratory.
Right. It's probably important for us to understand that one facet of what Mr. Loomis was doing is that he was bringing into Tuxedo Park scientists who were, in one way or another, foreigners, not born in America. Many of them were also Jews. And that in both of these cases, we are talking about people who, at least in some parts of that community, would have been very much unwelcome. What kind of risk are we talking about here in terms of what Alfred Lee Loomis was doing?
What he was doing was really risking his social status, which had meant so much to him when he was younger, but he came to really almost scorn it, that what he was building was something that was very important to him, and he realized how important it was to the world, and he really began to just not care what his neighbors thought. The only people he cared about, in fact, were his fellow scientists. And we're now getting into the 30s, and of course, as the Nazis are coming to power in Germany, a lot of their scientists are having to leave, of course, the Jewish scientists, first of all. And we've forgotten how pervasive anti-Semitism was here before the war. It was really the Nazis who made it disrespectable. So the anti-Semitism was common and accepted. And beyond that, there was just a general almost hysteria about immigrants in general and foreigners. And so when they all start turning up in Tuxedo Park, of all places, his neighbors were really outraged. And it was remarkable enough that it even caught the attention of the press. So they started to pay attention to this kind of reclusive, oddball, wealthy, eccentric scientist working away in his Gothic mansion. And it's very kind of Bruce Wayne. And it fit Dr. Frankenstein perfectly. He starts getting attention in the press that he really did not like at all. He wanted nothing to do with the press, but that's what came to him as a result of inviting foreigners and Jews into Tuxedo Park.
Right, and it's interesting. You show us in the film examples of some of the headlines that were affixed to some of these stories about maybe potentially dangerous experiments and strange experiments that were being done behind closed doors. And of course, because it was being done in secret, in a sense, reporters and ordinary people were kind of left to their own wild imaginations about what might be going on. How significant was this work that he was doing in these early years involving sound waves? And what did he ultimately accomplish in those early years, if anything?
Well, it ended up being really quite important. As I mentioned, they bought this high-frequency oscillator. So, audible sound goes up to about 20,000 cycles per second. And so he's working at several times that 100, 200,000 cycles per second. And they were interested in how these high-frequency waves, so they would send these high-frequency waves out through liquid, and they were seeing how it interacted with organisms. So they were, in fact, killing animals and so on, experimenting with mice and so on. And this is what caught the attention of the press. And it's, of course, like so many other things, science is handled differently these days. But what came out of it, among other things, was ultrasound, that they invented a device which really was the precursor to modern ultrasound instruments. And so when we get to look at a fetus without disturbing it or any of the other thousands of uses of ultrasound, that all started in Tuxedo Park. And there were other things that there was one that I love, that he found a way to induce a fever by exposing people to high frequency waves. And it sounds like just getting in a microwave, basically. But I hate to think how they figured this out. But they were able to. This became a new treatment for malaria, I think it was, because they used to treat it by. It was other conditions that they would treat by exposing people to malarial mosquitoes so that they would get a fever and that would kill the disease. And so they used this to induce a fever artificially so you wouldn't have to get malaria in order to get rid of whatever else you had.
Hmm. I was intrigued, too, by the work that he did in terms of better understanding sleep and the stages of sleep. And I suspect some of this exploration was being done at a time when almost nobody had the slightest idea about
That's
such
right.
things.
That's right. People had suggested this, but then scientists had gone and tried to measure it, and they'd said, no, that's crazy. This doesn't exist. This is just a myth. And Loomis basically said, well, your instruments aren't good enough. And what he was, one of the things he was very good at was building just very precise, beautifully engineered gear. And so he built a device to measure the brainwaves, basically. And he used subjects such as his son, and who had a knack for falling asleep very easily. And so they would wire him up with all these sensors, and somehow the kid would fall asleep. And they would measure over the course of the hours on this huge roll that just kind of turned very slowly, and there were all these kind of lines being drawn to measure the brain waves. And I don't fully understand the technology, but that's the essence of it. And so they were able to categorize the different stages of sleep, which all that science is still fundamental to our understanding of sleep today.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Rob Rapley about his fascinating film, The Secret of Tuxedo Park, which airs tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, for the American Experience series. So we get to the heart of the story now, which is as the storm clouds of war are on the horizon, that is, the storm clouds of the Second World War in the late 1930s. Your film explains how, by and large, the American public had no interest whatsoever in being any part at all in these growing tensions and escalating conflicts in Europe. And Alfred Loomis is one of the few Americans who sees the situation differently. First of all, just say a quick word about this fervent sense of isolationism in America at that point. I'm really glad that you take the time to help us understand this, because it really sets Loomis's work in proper context.
It was really, really remarkable. A lot of Americans felt, I think with some justification, that they had been kind of suckered in the First World War, that the British in particular had used them, and the, you know, all those lives had been, and money had been basically used to preserve the British Empire. That Churchill came over, and he was quoted saying, "Oh, you know, you didn't need to come in. We would have won it ourselves." And you did nothing, kind of thing. And then during the Depression, a lot of the European countries that had borrowed massive amounts of money from the United States during the war defaulted on their loans. And that wasn't the cause of the Great Depression, but a lot of Americans understandably thought, well, wait a second, you know, they borrowed $100 billion from us or whatever it was, then they've defaulted on it, now we have no money. And so, no, we're not coming in and doing this for you again, and we're not wasting our lives or our treasure. And it was a really, really powerful impulse. And also it kind of on the fringes took on a conspiratorial air, that you had a lot of people saying that it was the international bankers and Jews, of course, who were manipulating the world politics to their own benefit. And and so you had preachers like people like Charles Coughlin, the famous priest, and who was making broadcasts, and Charles Lindbergh was very prominently anti-war, and also, you know, very kind of promoting this idea that it was the international cabal of Jewish bankers that were promoting this war. So it was a very powerful political current. Loomis, on the other hand, is very much in the scientific world. So he is talking to all of these refugees from Nazi Germany and traveling over there and seeing Nazi Germany for himself. He traveled through the country a few times in the 30s and was horrified, and was, you know, keeping up with things like the race laws and the Nuremberg laws passed in 35 and so on. And so as the situation is deteriorating there, he was one of a small group of Americans who were actually doing everything they could to highlight the danger and eventually to prepare for what they thought was an inevitable war.
It is so interesting to think about the ways in which we were desperately behind German scientists of the day. Help us understand just what that distance was or that point of disadvantage was and how important it was for that difference to be made up.
Well, almost as soon as the Nazis came to power in Germany in 1933, they started funding an enormous expansion of scientific research, all of it aimed at military technology. So they were working on jet engines and what eventually became the V-2 ballistic rocket and munitions and tanks, and all of this science was being funded lavishly by the Nazis, all with borrowed money. The whole plan was, we're going to spend all this money and then have a war and we'll get the money back from the countries that we conquer. The West, on the other hand, was determined never to go to war again. And in America, understandably, I think that the focus was on turning science to civilian uses, and there was no government push for military science at all. In fact, there was barely a military between the wars. And so, as a result, Nazi Germany pulled far, far, far ahead of its competitors. And by the late 1930s, there was real competition. The Nazis were just far, far ahead of everyone else. And say in 1938 or so, after the Munich crisis, finally, Britain, and to a lesser extent, the United States, started to think, oh, wait a second, maybe we'd better start to catch up. War may in fact be coming, but they were way behind by that point.
Mm. It is so interesting to see the focus that Loomis and some of his colleagues take at this point in time, in particular when it came to this still quite new technology of radar. What were the ways in which radar needed to be, in a sense, perfected and made in a sense, more valuable, more usable? And maybe as you're explaining that, you can also explain this notion of radar and what it could be used for, because there were a couple of different schools for thought that were really kind of complicating the picture.
That's right. The idea of radar had been around, but it was really only in the 1930s, partly as the Germans were developing this massive air force, and the bomber in particular, that people developed a fixation with the bomber. It was almost like the fear of nuclear war in the 60s and 50s. And so there seemed to be no defense against it, and radar offered a hope. And basically the way radar works, as somebody makes the analogy in a film, you drop a pebble in a pond and the ripples of water go out. And then when they strike an object, part of that wave will be reflected back. And if it's strong enough, that wave will come back to the source. And so that's exactly what you do with radar. You send out waves through the atmosphere and they hit an object and bounce back. And you can monitor those reflected waves at the source, and so you can see what's out there. And the British had really in the last, in 1938-39, had a frantic building program to build these radar stations around the southeast coast of Britain so that they could detect formations of aircraft as they were forming up in northern France, just across the channel. These were built with what's called long-wave radar, which was the first kind of radar that was developed. And the size of the radar dish, the transmitter and receiver, is proportionate to the wavelength. And so the British radar stations were big buildings with antenna that went hundreds of feet into the sky with these huge arrays, and they made the difference in the Battle of Britain. It's the most famous use of radar in the Second World War, and saved Britain and all the rest of us from a Nazi future. Even before the war started, Loomis and some other people saw that the next generation was going to be microwave radar. So this would be a kind of radar which operated on the same principle, but because it was using short wavelengths, you'd be able to have a much smaller unit to receive and transmit those waves, and so you could fit it in an airplane, for example, or on a ship, or eventually in an artillery shell. And so there was one huge hurdle to this technology. People kind of understood the principle, but there would seem to be no getting around this one huge hurdle, which was building a generator that could make microwaves that were powerful enough to be useful. And Loomis was frantically working at this through 1939, even before the war in Europe started, working 7 days a week trying to get around this problem, but he couldn't figure it out. And so it looked for a time as if all of his work was going to be for naught, because they just couldn't get past this hurdle.
Right. And maybe we'll leave it to our listeners to understand and learn from your film how this hurdle is eventually surmounted. It is a very, very interesting turn in the story that really gives us a lot to think about in terms of how science functions and how scientists work together. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to interrupt. The film now, The Darkest Hour, it just to set the context, this is the time frame in which this problem will get solved, and I thought it was interesting watching that film, that finally that period of time is really coming into, Dunkirk and Darkest Hour is coming to be popularized.
Absolutely, and now we can see that really critical turning point in our own history from yet another perspective. Say a quick word about the so-called Rad Lab, and this is the new arena in which Loomis took some of this work.
That's right. So when they realized, okay, we have this new technology, we need to build it quickly. And now America still wasn't in the war, but they were already thinking ahead to, we would need to build vast numbers of these things. We need to kind of harness industry, science, and the military, and kind of have these disparate kind of forces working together. And this really hadn't been done. The Army had its proving ground at Aberdeen and so on in the First World War, but armies and militaries ran research facilities, but they hadn't really built a facility that synthesized those different kind of forces. And Loomis was really the right guy in the right place at the right time. He had all this experience on Wall Street, working on the electrification of America. He had been in the military during the war, and of course he had connections all through the scientific world and a very fine scientific mind himself, and really developed this facility that played an absolutely critical, absolutely central role in the Allied victory, which then became kind of the model, the starting off point for what would eventually become the military-industrial complex, these huge enterprises at the intersection of the military and industry and science.
Mm. Explain how the landscape begins to change so drastically. I mean, what kind of new era did Loomis, in a sense, usher in?
Yeah, paradoxically, he modeled himself after these gentleman scientists, these independent operations, the wealthy scientists working on their own. But as a result of his work and really the developing the Rad Lab, he kind of put the gentleman scientists out of business, in part because the sums of money that were being spent, and Los Alamos, of course, is the other famous example, more famous example during the Second World War, that, you know, his fortune, say, in the 30s was $30 million or something, that billions of dollars were being spent at Los Alamos and even more money at the Rad Lab. The Rad Lab, they spent several times as much money as they did at Los Alamos. So there's no way that an individual, no matter how wealthy, can compete with that.
Your story, your film also shares something about Alfred Lee Loomis's complicated personal life and who he was as a husband, as a father. You have some of his descendants in the film speaking about him. I suspect that they must have appreciated the opportunity to help share this story, even if some aspects of the story are a little bit painful on a personal level.
I think so. Loomis's private life was a contrast with his public one, in at least one respect, that he had an affair with and eventually married the younger wife of one of his colleagues, his protege, in fact. So, people fall in love and get married and get divorced and so on. That's not the first time that's ever happened. But what was kind of people thought was unforgivable was the way he treated his wife while all this was going on. That too, she had health problems of her own, but really to get her out of the way, he essentially had her committed. That you know, as their marriage was getting difficult, she was spending more and more time kind of at spas and sanitariums and so on. But eventually, he used that to get her out of the way and essentially had her committed. This is at the very end of the war, while his three sons were all away at the war, and when they came home and realized what he'd done, they were, of course, just staggered. And one of them went and rescued his mother and basically never spoke to his father again. So it was, this contributed to Loomis's obscurity, because this is happening right at the end of the war, and the reaction among his peers and in the whatever press there was of course very negative, and he just decided to kind of retire from the world at that time. So it, you know, it goes to show that often, you know, somebody said that, you know, he was a wonderful scientist, but he kind of was missing an essential part of being a person, you know, that he wasn't a great father and certainly wasn't a very good husband.
It's such a fascinating film, such an amazing story, and an important story for all of us to know. The film, again, is called The Secret of Tuxedo Park, airing tonight on PBS across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. The film written and directed by Rob Rapley. Rob Rapley, congratulations on a fine film, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will be speaking with two former social secretaries for the White House, one who served under President George W. Bush, the other who served under President Barack Obama. And they have co-written a marvelous, fascinating book called Treating People Well, about the importance of civility in modern life. Also tomorrow, Brody Rose. He is the son of Jack Rose, who is a frequent guest on The Morning Show, talking about issues related to mental illness. Brody Rose himself has contended with some difficulties, including crippling depression, and has risen above those challenges very, very impressively. And we talk to Brody Rose on tomorrow's Morning Show. And on Thursday, a preview